Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this underlying expectation of just absolute precision.
Right, yeah, like a machine.
Exactly. We want it to be like mechanical engineering. Like if you fall and break your arm, you go to the hospital, they put you in an X-ray machine, and it prints out that stark high contrast image.
The black and white film.
Yeah. And then the
Yeah.
doctor just points to a jagged white line on the film and says, you know, there it is. That's the problem. We fix this line.
It's very binary, which is incredibly comforting to us.
Yeah.
It's either broken or not broken.
Right.
We have this deep psychological craving for things to be visible, to be neatly categorized, and to have a single identifiable point of failure that we can just go in and fix.
But then you step away from the simple bone fracture and into the world of, say, neurodevelopment or chronic autoimmune conditions or the effects of systemic trauma.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole different ball game.
Suddenly, that metaphorical X-ray machine is completely useless. You aren't looking at a clean break anymore. You're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky.
Very murky.
You're trying to measure variables that interact invisibly, symptoms that change day by day, and these weird feedback loops that just don't show up on any standard scan.
And that feeling, of staring into the muddy waters, it's terrifying for people who are trained to look for clean lines.
Yeah.
It's the absolute definition of diagnostic ambiguity. But, and this is crucial, it's also a perfect reflection of how almost everything in our modern, interconnected world actually operates.
Which is the exact jumping off point for our deep dive today. We are
Okay.
taking you, the listener, right into those muddy
So
waters.
giddy deep.
We are exploring a really profound question. Why do highly complex systems, and by that I mean modern hospitals, sprawling bureaucratic governments, global environmental networks, and massive multinational corporations, why do they consistently fail?
Even when all the pieces seem fine.
Right. Even when all their individual parts, their brilliant experts, and their cutting-edge technologies seem to be functioning perfectly.
It really is the ultimate paradox of our age. I mean, think about it. We have more data at our fingertips right now than at any point in human
Oh,
history.
absolutely. Mountains of it.
We have more specialized expertise, more sensors, more algorithmic processing power, and just more technological control. Yet we continually watch these massive, sophisticated systems break down in ways that catch the people running them completely off guard.
It's like supply chains just collapse overnight.
Exactly. Or ecological thresholds are crossed while environmental agencies are busy publishing these glowing positive reports.
Yeah, or corporate giants implode while their quarterly dashboards show record efficiency.
Right.
So, to understand why that paradox exists, we are unpacking an incredible piece of source material today. It's a comprehensive theoretical document called The Field of Coherence: Perception, Value, and Systemic Alignment in Complex Systems by Dr. Bechara Saley.
It's a brilliant text.
And what makes this text so fascinating is the way it was constructed. Dr. Saefeli used computational synthesis and analytical support from AI systems, specifically ChatGPT, Gemini, and NotebookLM.
Acting as collaborative partners, basically.
Right, acting as partners to map out these massive cross-disciplinary patterns.
And the synthesis is remarkable because it refuses to stay in one academic lane. It pulls from the biology of how living things perceive their environment, integrates that with sociological systems theory, grounds it all in philosophy, and then applies it directly to practical diagnostics.
And the core premise of this document, the hook, that completely changed how I look at the news every morning, honestly, is totally counterintuitive.
It really flips your perspective.
Because we usually imagine systemic failure as a sudden, explosive breakdown. A bridge collapses because a beam snaps. But this text argues that in complex systems, failure isn't a sudden explosion.
Not at all.
It's a quiet, gradual, almost invisible process where perception, interpretation, and action slowly drift out of alignment with reality. By the time the explosion actually happens, the system has actually been failing for years.
Which is why this framework matters so deeply, regardless of what you do for a living.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're listening to this on your commute, think about the environment you're heading into.
Yeah, apply this to your own life.
Whether you manage a small team, navigate a Byzantine corporate bureaucracy, or you're just trying to make sense of the chaotic geopolitical world, the traditional models we've been taught are failing us.
Big time.
We've been trained to view systems as machines with interchangeable parts.
Yeah.
You optimize the parts, you control the machine.
Pull a lever, get a result.
Right. But this text argues we desperately need to abandon that mechanical view. We have to start seeing systems as relational fields.
Okay, let's unpack that. A relational field.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to understand how these complex systems fail, we have to start at the very foundation, which is how we actually look at them.
The lens itself.
Yeah. And I think this is where most of us trip up right out of the gate.
Right.
We have this implicit assumption that if we just gather enough data, install enough sensors, write enough comprehensive reports, we can eventually see the whole system.
The God's eye view.
Exactly.
Right.
We can achieve this perfect, objective, top-down view of reality. But Dr. Sahili's text uses biology to argue that this is structurally impossible.
It is the great myth of the modern era, the myth of the perfect view. The text grounds this refutation in the work of the renowned biologist Humberto Maturana.
Okay, Maturana.
Specifically, his theory of the biology of cognition. Maturana's breakthrough insight was that perception is fundamentally and inescapably conditioned by the physical structure of the observer.
Wait, let me try to put a biological analogy to this to see if I'm tracking, because I read this and it blew my mind. Think about a frog.
Okay, a frog.
A frog's visual system is structurally wired to detect small, erratic movements.
Right.
If you put a frog in a box filled with freshly dead, motionless flies, the frog will actually starve to death. It literally cannot perceive the food right in front of it because its biological structure just doesn't register stationary objects as food. The frog isn't broken, you know. Its reality is just entirely defined by its structural constraints.
That is a phenomenal example, and it captures Maturana's point perfectly. We do not passively receive reality like a security camera recording a room.
Right. We aren't just objective lenses.
Exactly. We enact reality based on our internal organization. The frog enacts a reality of moving objects. Humans enact a reality based on our sensory organs, our neural processing, and critically, our social and institutional frameworks.
So what you can see is entirely determined by the specific ways you are capable of interacting with your environment.
That's it.
So perception isn't a window we look through. It's an active relationship we are building.
Maturana calls this concept structural coupling. Reality, as we experience it, is a relational achievement. It's born from the continuous, repeated interactions between an organism or an observer and its environment. You only perceive what your structure allows you to distinguish.
If we take that frog analogy and scale it up, you know, to the human, corporate, or governmental level, it absolutely shatters that myth of the privileged observer.
It really does. It demolishes.
Because we have this lingering belief that there is some CEO in a corner office or a lead surgeon in a hospital or even like an advanced algorithmic dashboard that holds a complete top-down objective view of everything happening in the system.
We cling to that illusion because it gives us a sense of control.
Yeah.
But nobody has that view. Knowledge is always situated. It is always partial.
Okay, so map that onto the CEO.
If you are a CEO, your structure is defined by profit and loss statements, quarterly earnings, and board meetings. You are structurally coupled to financial metrics.
Right.
Therefore, that is the reality you enact. You are functionally blind to the intricate social dynamics of the warehouse floor. Not because you are a bad person, but because those dynamics don't register in your structural framework.
They're the dead flies.
Exactly. They are the dead flies for the frog.
And what really struck me in the text is that it emphasizes this isn't a defect. Like, we are constantly treating our limited perception as a failure of knowledge that we just need to fix.
Yes. If we just buy better software.
Or hold more meetings, we'll fix it. But it's not a bug in the software. It's the operating system itself. It is a fundamental condition of existing inside a complex system.
Which fundamentally changes how we should treat our representations of the world. When we create organizational charts, financial reports, or diagnostic models, we like to pretend they are neutral reflections of reality.
Objective facts.
Right. But because of structural coupling, those representations are actually active components of the system. They highlight the things the observer's structure cares about, and by definition, they obscure everything else.
Okay, let me push back on this a little bit, because I can hear a skeptical listener saying, okay, sure, we all have partial views, but isn't that just the old parable of the blind men and the elephant?
Oh, sure, the classic parable.
You know the story. Six blind men encounter an elephant. One feels the trunk and says it's a snake. One feels the leg and says it's a tree. One feels the ear and says it's a fan.
Right.
The standard corporate solution to this is just get all the blind men into a conference room, have them share their data points, and boom, you've mathematically reconstructed the whole elephant. Problem solved, right?
The standard assumption is that collaboration perfectly solves partial perception. Just put everyone in a room. But the framework we're discussing takes it much deeper and exposes the flaw in the elephant analogy itself.
How so?
In that parable, the blind men are functionally equal. They are just standing in different physical locations around the animal.
Okay.
But in a real complex human system, observers aren't just standing in different spots. They're operating under completely different constraints, power dynamics, and institutional incentives.
Oh, I see. Wow. So to make the elephant analogy accurate to the real world, the blind man feeling the trunk is the VP of sales, and his bonus is tied to finding snakes. The blind man feeling the leg is the safety compliance officer, and he gets fired if he doesn't report a tree.
Exactly.
They aren't just touching different parts. They have different rules governing what they are even allowed to perceive and report.
That is exactly the dynamic. When you relate partial perspectives in a real system, they don't automatically snap together into a perfect objective map like puzzle pieces, because their underlying frameworks and incentives are actively conflicting.
So what happens when they try to share information?
The act of sharing information actually creates what the text calls divergence.
Divergence. Okay, so because we are structurally coupled to different realities and governed by different constraints, we naturally and inevitably generate different interpretations of the same environment.
It's unavoidable.
Which brings us to a massive question. If divergence is the default condition of human systems, and not just an error we can train out of people, how does a system keep from just tearing itself apart?
That is the fundamental challenge of all human coordination. Now, it's vital to note that the text doesn't view divergence as inherently bad.
It doesn't.
No. In fact, divergence can be highly productive. It provides a system with flexibility. If you are in a hospital, you want the divergent perspectives of the attending surgeon, the bedside nurse, and the clinical pharmacist.
Right, because they're looking at different things.
Exactly. The surgeon is structurally coupled to the surgical intervention, the nurse is coupled to the patient's hour-by-hour stability, and the pharmacist is coupled to chemical interactions. That divergence is necessary for the hospital to adapt to complex patient needs.
But the flip side is that divergence can become destructive. It leads to fragmentation, where those different perspectives become siloed and no longer connect at all.
Yes, when communication breaks down.
The surgeon ignores the nurse, the pharmacist overrules the surgeon, and the patient suffers. So what's the glue? How do we integrate these differing views without it just devolving into a power struggle over who has the quote-unquote right reality?
The text outlines four specific necessary conditions for productive integration. First is signal accessibility. The relevant information actually has to be available to everyone, not hoarded by one department.
Makes sense.
Second is interpretive openness. Observers must be willing and culturally permitted to consider alternative perspectives without immediately dismissing them as irrelevant.
Like actually listening to the other blind men?
Right. Third is relational connectivity. There must be actual functional communication pathways that allow these perspectives to interact, not just formal meetings, but genuine dialogue.
Okay.
And fourth is temporal responsiveness. These differences have to be addressed in time before the underlying conditions degrade irreversibly.
That makes intuitive sense, but let's bring back that idea of unequal observers we touched on with the elephant, because real systems aren't utopian town halls where everyone shares ideas equally and the best argument wins. Systems are, as the text describes them, structured fields of constraint.
They are heavily constrained. They are bound by physical limits, rigid institutional rules, finite budgets, and uneven resource distributions.
Yeah.
And this brings us to a crucial concept incorporated into the text, developed by the sociologist Johann Galtung, the structural conditions of harm. This is often referred to in sociology as structural violence.
That is a heavy, emotionally charged term, structural violence.
It is.
But it's a vital concept to grasp because it fundamentally shifts how we assign blame. It essentially means that a system can produce profound harm without anyone inside that system actually having malicious intent or actively trying to hurt anyone.
It's a tragedy of structure. Structural harm arises when locally rational actions, actions that make perfect logical sense to an individual operating under their specific constraints, aggregate into system-level harm.
Okay, locally rational. I like that term.
And this dynamic is entirely driven by what the text calls the asymmetry of influence.
Asymmetry of influence, meaning some people's partial views get to dictate reality for everyone else?
Yes. In any complex system, not all perspectives carry equal weight. Some agents, like executives, policymakers, or the designer of the algorithmic dashboard, have the power to shape the flow of information, to set the KPIs, to define the incentives, and to write the rules of the game.
While others just have to follow them.
Exactly. Other agents merely operate within the flows and rules that have been handed down to them. This asymmetry guarantees that systemic misalignment isn't just a random error. It is systematically patterned by the architecture of the organization.
Let's ground this in a real-world scenario so the listener can really feel how this works. Think about a massive e-commerce warehouse operation.
Perfect example.
You have an executive sitting at corporate headquarters who implements a new, heavily optimized routing policy for warehouse workers to save, say, 3 seconds per package.
Right.
Now, from the executive's restricted view, looking only at logistics dashboards, quarterly budgets, and throughput metrics, this policy is entirely rational. In fact, it's brilliant.
It looks great on a spreadsheet.
And because they hold the asymmetry of influence, they enforce it across the entire company. But what is the reality for the people on the ground?
Well, the frontline warehouse workers are operating under entirely different constraints. They are dealing with physical fatigue, broken conveyor belts, unpredictable package weights, and, you know, the biological necessity of taking a breath.
Yeah, being human.
The executive's locally rational policy creates profound structural harm for the frontline workers. It forces them to move in ways that cause physical injury or to skip breaks, degrading their well-being.
And here is the kicker. Because of that same asymmetry of influence, the frontline worker's perspective on this harm struggles immensely to travel back up the chain of command.
The dashboard doesn't show it.
Exactly. The dashboard the executive looks at doesn't have a metric for worker joint pain. It just shows the packages moving 3 seconds faster.
And that disconnect is the mechanism of failure. We've established that people are locked into partial views, and those views are constrained by uneven power dynamics. So how do these isolated, constrained people attempt to communicate their reality to the rest of the system?
How do they do it?
They use signals. But as the text explores deeply, these signals do not travel cleanly through the organization. They get warped.
Which is the perfect transition to the next major phase of this framework. We move from understanding perception to understanding communication. How do signals become stories?
Yes.
To explain how signals get warped, Dr. Sakhili formally introduces the concept of the relational field.
The relational field is a powerful way to conceptualize an organization. It is the structured space of interactions where agents, signals, constraints, and actions are all mutually constituted.
Mutually constituted, meaning they all build on each other.
Exactly. Imagine it as a magnetic field. Nothing exists in isolation. The behavior of an iron filing is defined entirely by its relationship to the invisible field around it. In human systems, our behaviors, our reports, and our decisions are shaped by the relational field we inhabit.
And within this magnetic relational field, the text defines coherence in a very specific, almost mechanical way.
It does.
Because we usually use the word coherence to mean, you know, everyone is getting along and holding hands. But here, coherence simply means alignment across the relational field.
Alignment of perception, interpretation, and action, such that coordinated activity remains possible. An army marching in lockstep off a cliff is highly coherent.
Wow.
They are perfectly aligned. But how do the signals that tell the army to march move through this field to create that alignment? They move through the dense filter of incentives.
Incentives act as filters. That is an incredibly clarifying image.
Incentives are the gravitational pull of the relational field. They determine which signals are amplified and which are suppressed. Let's go back to your e-commerce warehouse example. If a signal aligns with the prevailing incentives, say, a middle manager produces a report showing that the new 3-second routing policy is saving the company millions, that signal is heavily amplified.
It gets put in a PowerPoint.
It is pushed up the chain, celebrated in meetings, and distributed in memos. It travels with zero friction.
But what if a signal challenges those incentives? What if a floor supervisor tries to send up a report saying that the new policy is causing a massive spike in worker injuries and turnover?
That signal faces immense structural friction. It challenges the CEO's brilliant idea. It threatens the middle manager's bonus. So the field suppresses it.
Just automatically.
It doesn't even require malicious censorship. It happens organically. The report gets lost in the shuffle, or the data is questioned, or the supervisor is told they just need to manage their team better. The signal is ignored or aggressively reinterpreted until it no longer threatens the prevailing incentive structure.
And as these filtered signals bounce around the system, amplifying the good news and suppressing the bad, something incredibly dangerous takes root. The system undergoes what the text calls narrative stabilization.
Yes.
It transitions from simply observing the environment to actively maintaining a story about the environment.
This is a critical evolutionary threshold for any organization. Narratives are biologically and socially essential. They reduce the infinite complexity of the world into manageable chunks. They allow large groups of people to coordinate their actions around a shared goal.
We need stories to function.
We do. But this efficiency comes at a steep, often fatal cost. Once a narrative stabilizes, once the story becomes the official reality, it begins to actively and automatically filter out any disconfirming evidence.
It puts blinders on.
The system shifts its energy from interpreting the real world to protecting its story about the world.
So the distortion just propagates and compounds. It starts as a small discrepancy, maybe a few ignored complaints from the warehouse floor, but the institutional routines and the incentive structures reinforce it daily. Eventually, the system literally starts producing signals that only fit the narrative.
This brings us to one of the most vital distinctions in the entire document, the profound difference between coherence and adequacy.
Okay, unpack that.
As we noted, a system can remain highly coherent. Everyone agrees on the official narrative, everyone is acting in coordinated ways, all the quarterly reports look perfectly consistent. Yet that coherent system can be completely, hopelessly misaligned with the actual reality of its environment.
So coherence is just about internal agreement.
Exactly. Coherence does not equal adequacy. You can have a perfectly coherent failure.
Let me offer an everyday analogy that I think perfectly captures this. Have you ever been part of a group of friends who convinced themselves that a truly terrible restaurant is actually amazing?
Oh, absolutely. A classic scenario.
Let's say one friend who considers themselves a foodie picks an incredibly expensive, exclusive new spot. You all go. The food arrives cold, the portions are microscopic, and the waiter is incredibly rude.
Miserable experience. What happens to the signals?
Well, the signals, the cold food, the bad service, are aggressively suppressed because nobody wants to insult the friend who picked the place.
Right.
And everyone wants to feel like they're sophisticated enough to get the vibe. So the narrative stabilizes. We are having an amazing time at the hottest restaurant in town.
And if someone speaks up?
If someone mentions the food is cold, the group aggressively reinterprets it. Oh, no, no, it's a rustic avant-garde temperature play.
Right.
The group remains totally coherent. No one is arguing. They are completely aligned. But they are still sitting there paying a fortune, eating a terrible dinner.
That is a flawless micro-level example of narrative stabilization leading to systemic distortion. Everyone in that friend group is actively cooperating to maintain the illusion, and they are doing so because the social incentive to maintain harmony overrides the biological signal of bad food.
But in the real world, the stakes are vastly higher than a bad dinner. When a hospital, a government, or an ecosystem stabilizes around a false narrative, the results are catastrophic.
Devastating.
Which takes us into the phase where things get truly perilous, the dashboard trap and epistemic closure. Because once that narrative hardens into concrete, the system's feedback loops degrade entirely.
And the system enters its most dangerous phase of existence. To explain the mechanics of this phase, the text visualizes a contrast between what it calls the distorted dashboard and the underlying conditions.
If you're listening, imagine you are flying a highly advanced commercial airliner. Up in the cockpit, you have your dashboard. It's glowing with green metrics. Your altimeter says you are at 30,000 feet.
Everything looks fine.
Your engine efficiency is optimal. Your speed is perfect. Everything on the dashboard tells you that you are flying flawlessly.
But down below, the underlying reality is entirely different. The true conditions are degrading. You are actually losing altitude rapidly, and there is a mountain range dead ahead.
The critical concept here is what happens in the space between the actual mountain and the glowing dashboard. The text calls this signal reality decoupling. The arrows of information that are supposed to connect the underlying reality to your dashboard have been bent, filtered, delayed, and selectively aggregated by those incentives we just talked about.
So the dashboard no longer reflects reality. It reflects a transformed, highly curated version of reality that has been scrubbed clean so it conforms to the system's stabilized narrative.
Wow.
In the cockpit analogy, your altimeter isn't broken. It's been programmed to only show 30,000 feet because the airline incentivized pilots to never fly lower than that.
And when a system, whether it's an airline, a central bank, or a corporate board, begins to rely entirely on that decoupled dashboard to make its decisions, it enters a state of epistemic closure.
That's the term.
It loses the fundamental capacity to even recognize its own distortion.
This is where we must introduce the terrifying mechanism of second-order distortion.
Second-order distortion.
Right. First-order distortion is common. It's simply misinterpreting a signal. You read a thermometer wrong, or a sensor glitches. But second-order distortion is a structural pathology. It is the loss of the awareness that you are misinterpreting anything at all.
Wait, so they lose the capacity for doubt?
Yes. You no longer possess the structural capacity for doubt.
The system experiences its own interpretations, its own curated dashboard metrics, as totally objectively self-evident. Like, of course we're doing great. Just look at the quarterly earnings.
And how does the system lose its capacity for doubt? It happens through the degradation of what the text calls the epistemic commons.
The epistemic commons.
Think of the epistemic commons as the shared relational space within an organization where raw signals can circulate openly, where multiple conflicting perspectives are maintained and respected, and most importantly, where doubt is culturally permitted and protected.
So it's the space where the junior engineer is allowed to raise their hand and say, I think the O-ring might fail in cold weather without getting fired.
Precisely. But when narrative stabilization takes hold, the organization actively attacks the epistemic commons. Whistleblowers are ousted because they aren't team players.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Hiring processes optimize for culture fit, which just means hiring people who already agree with the dashboard. Slowly, the shared space for doubt is paved over. Without doubt, the system cannot recalibrate. It becomes fundamentally incapable of learning.
The text gives us a mathematical way to think about this. System awareness is directly proportional to signal fidelity to underlying conditions.
Yeah.
It has absolutely nothing to do with how much data you have on your dashboard. You could have a dashboard with 10,000 real-time metrics, but if those metrics lack fidelity to the messy underlying reality, your system awareness is exactly zero.
Epistemic closure is never a lack of data. In fact, a system in epistemic closure is usually drowning in data.
Just bad data.
Exactly. It's the specific structural inability to register disconfirming data as relevant. The system becomes structurally blind while believing it has perfect 20/20 vision.
Here is where I really had to pause and think while reading the source material. If the dashboard is glowing green, if efficiency is technically up, and everyone in your echo chamber is violently agreeing with the narrative, how on earth is a leader, or even a mid-level manager, supposed to know they are suffering from epistemic closure?
It's the hardest thing to see from the inside.
If you fundamentally don't know what you don't know, how do you wake up?
That is the pivotal question of the entire framework, and the hardest one to answer. Waking up from epistemic closure cannot be achieved simply by staring harder at the dashboard or by hiring consultants to build you a new dashboard.
More metrics won't help.
No. It requires the painful, slow work of rebuilding the epistemic commons. And to rebuild that shared space, the text argues we have to rely on a mechanism that the modern hyper-rational industrial world usually dismisses as just a squishy, soft emotion.
Which brings us to the next vital phase of our deep dive. Trust and action as navigation. To break epistemic closure, we need trust.
Yes, but we need to completely redefine how we think about trust. The text defines trust in a highly specific operational way. It's not about goodwill or liking your coworkers or doing trust falls at a corporate retreat.
Right.
Trust is defined as the essential threshold condition under which signals are accepted as actionable across different agents.
Let's break that down. Because it's a dense definition, a threshold condition for signals to be actionable.
Think about a fire alarm. The alarm is a perfect, loud, accurate signal. But imagine you work in a building where someone pulls the fire alarm as a prank every single Tuesday.
Okay, the boy who cried wolf.
Exactly. When the alarm goes off on Wednesday, the signal is 100% accurate there was a real fire. But your trust in the system has fallen below the operational threshold. Therefore, the signal is not actionable. You stay at your desk.
Wow. So if trust is absent, it literally doesn't matter how accurate or urgent a signal is.
Doesn't matter at all.
The system will ignore it, discount it, or view it with extreme suspicion. You can present a perfectly researched, data-backed report proving that the company is heading for bankruptcy. But without relational trust, the system cannot integrate that data into coordinated action.
Trust isn't a feeling. It is the physical lubricant that allows information to move through the relational field without being destroyed by friction.
Okay, so assuming we recognize the problem, we start rebuilding trust, we restore the epistemic commons, and we actually start to receive real, unfiltered signals from the muddy waters of reality, how do we actually act on them?
Carefully.
Because if the system is as complex and fragile as we've established, we can't just run in with a sledgehammer and start changing policies.
This is where the framework makes a profound contrast between two paradigms of action. The industrial mindset of control versus the ecological mindset of navigation.
Control versus navigation.
The control mindset is the default for most leadership. Control assumes that you have full, objective knowledge of the system. It assumes your dashboard is perfect, that interactions between departments are linear, and that if you pull lever A, you will reliably and predictably get outcome B.
But based on everything we discussed about Maturana and structural coupling, we know that the perfect view is a biological myth.
Exactly. So attempting to control a complex system based on a partial, heavily distorted dashboard usually amplifies the distortion. You pull lever A, and because of hidden relational feedback loops you couldn't see, you accidentally cause an explosion in sector C.
Unintended consequences.
Your attempt to control the system breaks it further. Navigation, on the other hand, begins with humility. You accept that your knowledge is partial and situated. You are acting within a relational field, not standing outside of it.
Navigation. I love this concept. To make it concrete, let's go back to an analogy we touched on conceptually. The difference between control and navigation is like the difference in how you drive a car.
Good analogy.
The control mindset is setting your car on cruise control at 75 miles an hour, tying the steering wheel straight, and closing your eyes because you looked at a Google map 10 minutes ago and calculated that the road should be straight and clear.
In a perfectly static theoretical world, that control model would get you to your destination. But reality is relentlessly dynamic.
Exactly. The navigation mindset is actively driving. You have both hands on the wheel. You are keeping your eyes on the road, scanning the mirrors, feeling the vibration of the tires, and adjusting constantly to the flow of traffic.
Yes.
You know the map is just a representation, not the territory. And crucially, when you navigate, you maintain what the text calls optionality. You don't tailgate the 18-wheeler in front of you. You deliberately leave empty space, a margin of error, so that if a deer jumps out onto the highway, you have the option to swerve.
Taking that analogy further, margin is the defining characteristic of navigation. In a complex system, more action, more intervention is rarely better.
It can actually be worse.
Often worse. Minimal, continuously aligned actions that preserve the system's margin, its capacity to adapt and swerve, are vastly superior to massive top-down interventions based on the illusion of total control. Navigation isn't a strategy you execute once. It is a continuous, relentless practice of relational recalibration.
Okay, so we've learned how to see the system better, we've learned how signals warp, and we know we need to actively navigate rather than blindly control. But that begs the ultimate existential question. Where are we navigating to?
The destination.
We already established that internal coherence, everyone agreeing on the narrative, isn't enough to prove a system is healthy. An army can coherently march off a cliff, so we need an external measuring stick. We need a North Star to judge if our navigation is actually successful.
We do.
Which brings us to the philosophical core of our deep dive, the ultimate reality check value and the life ground.
If coherence isn't the ultimate measure of a system's adequacy, what is? To answer this, Dr. Sayalaili draws heavily on the work of the philosopher John McMurtry, specifically his foundational concept of the life ground and what he calls the primary axiom of value.
Let's lay out that axiom clearly because it is the anchor that holds this entire complex theory together.
The primary axiom of value states simply, that which enables or sustains life has value. That which destroys or degrades life has disvalue.
It sounds incredibly simple, almost like a truism.
It does.
But when you apply it to modern systems, it has massive disruptive implications. In economics or corporate strategy, we usually treat value as purely subjective or proxy-based.
Subjective preference.
Right. I value coffee, you value tea. The stock market values tech stocks over utilities. It's just a matter of preference or localized agreement. But the authors are using value objectively here. A system that destroys its own ecological foundation or burns out its human workforce is objectively failing, regardless of how high its profit margin climbs.
That is the radical, necessary shift. The life ground isn't an abstract moral ideal. It refers to the actual material, biological, ecological, and social conditions required to sustain life. The physical stuff. Clean water, breathable air, human rest, psychological safety, biodiversity. Value is anchored in physical reality, not on the spreadsheet. And this introduces the most destructive dynamic in the entire framework. Value inversion.
Value inversion. This happens when the dashboard completely consumes the reality.
Correct. Value inversion occurs when proxy metrics, things like GDP, quarterly profit, clinical throughput, test scores, or engagement clicks, stop being tools used to measure the system and become ends in themselves.
We start chasing the metric.
The system optimizes relentlessly for the proxy, and in doing so, it actively displaces and consumes the actual life ground conditions it ultimately relies on to exist.
The text details a specific contrast here between system use and system consumption, and it reintroduces that driving concept of margin, but defines it in a biological way. How does the framework define margin here?
It defines margin as available life capacity. This is the reservoir of health in a system. It could be the biological capacity of a forest to regrow, the social cohesion of a community, the physical stamina of a nursing staff, or simply the availability of unstructured time.
Time for rest.
Right. In a state of aligned system use, the actions of the system regenerate the life ground. It's a sustainable loop.
Okay.
But in a state of system consumption, driven by value inversion, the extraction of resources far exceeds the regeneration. The proxy metric on the dashboard goes up, profits soar, harvest yields break records, but the actual life capacity is quietly consumed until it collapses.
And the text pulls all of this together into what it calls the minimal architecture of coherence, mapping out the entire failure cascade. It's like the master blueprint of everything we've unpacked today.
It connects the epistemic, how we know the axiological, what we value, and the relational, how we interact.
How does the cascade start?
Under pressure, a system's perception compresses, leading to epistemic closure. Because it is blind, its selection shifts to optimizing artificial proxies, causing value inversion.
And then?
And because it is chasing proxies, local actions fail to integrate, causing widespread structural harm. The framework posits that a system's viability ultimately depends on an equation. Signal integrity multiplied by life capacity multiplied by coordinated action.
Signal integrity, life capacity, coordinated action.
If any one of those three variables drops to zero, the entire system fails.
The real tragedy here, as the text poignantly notes, is the sheer banality of it.
It's very mundane.
These systems don't usually act maliciously. The people destroying the environment or burning out the hospital staff aren't evil villains twisting their mustaches.
No, they're just doing their jobs.
They are incredibly smart, hardworking people acting rationally based on inverted values. They are trapped in what McMurtry calls the ruling group mind.
The ruling group mind is a stabilized, heavily defended pattern of perception and valuation that completely obscures the underlying degradation. Everyone in the boardroom believes they are doing the right thing because the glowing dashboard tells them they are succeeding brilliantly.
But the life ground is silently eroding beneath their feet.
Exactly.
This is incredibly profound. So we now understand the invisible architecture of failure. From structurally limited perception to the inevitability of divergence, to signals warped by incentives, to narrative stabilization, epistemic closure, and finally, the fatal trap of value inversion.
That's the whole path.
Now that we have the theoretical X-ray vision to see this architecture, how do we spot it happening in real time? Let's move to the final phase, spotting the invisible cracks. How do we apply this massive theory to the real world?
The text provides a framework for what it calls relational diagnostics. Because systemic failure isn't sudden, we have to train ourselves to look for early warning patterns. But remember the lesson of the dashboard. We aren't looking for discrete mechanical predictions.
Right, no crystal balls.
We are looking for shifts in the relational field itself.
The text identifies 5 specific early warning patterns that show up before a collapse. Divergence, delay, fragmentation, interference, and the compression of options. Let's look at how these invisible cracks appear across totally different domains. Let's start with clinical systems. Walk me through how this happens in a modern hospital.
Let's imagine a critical care unit. In a clinical setting, perception is highly distributed around the patient's bedside. You have the attending physician looking at lab results on a screen, the bedside nurse observing the patient's breathing patterns and skin tone, and the automated monitors tracking heart rate and oxygen saturation.
Lots of different views.
Divergence is perfectly natural here. But if relational trust breaks down, perhaps due to a hierarchical culture where nurses are afraid to question doctors, or simply due to extreme time pressure, narrative stabilization occurs prematurely.
They rush to a conclusion.
The team rapidly coalesces around a narrative. The patient is stable and recovering from surgery.
And once that stable narrative sets like concrete, the early warning signals are neutralized.
Yes.
The nurse notices a slight persistent drop in blood pressure or a subtle change in the patient's responsiveness. But because it contradicts the dominant narrative, the signal is ignored or explained away as, you know, just a machine calibration error, or they're just tired from the meds.
Precisely. The system enters a localized epistemic closure. And because those subtle signals are ignored, the patient's underlying physiological margin is consumed.
And that leads to the final stage.
This leads to the ultimate red flag, the compression of options. If the team had caught the subtle drop in blood pressure early, they had 50 different gentle interventions available. They had optionality.
Room to navigate.
But because they ignored it until the dashboard finally turns bright red and the patient codes, their options are severely compressed. They are down to extreme high-risk interventions like CPR and intubation. They are no longer navigating the patient's health. They are desperately trying to control a catastrophic crisis.
It's a terrifyingly clear example. Now, let's take those exact same five patterns: divergence, delay, fragmentation, interference, compression of options, and apply them to something on a massively different scale: environmental and infrastructure systems.
A huge jump in scale.
Here, we aren't talking about minutes or hours at a bedside. We are talking about years, decades, or centuries.
The systemic dynamics are identical, but the temporal scale stretches out, which actually makes the deception worse. Think about a regional water management system or a massive commercial fishery.
Okay, the fishery.
In environmental systems, the feedback signals are heavily delayed and deeply attenuated. If you dump a new pollutant into a river or you overfish a specific zone, you don't see the catastrophic ecosystem collapse the next day.
Right.
The margin, the life capacity of the ecosystem absorbs the damage for years. Because the feedback is so slow, these management systems become massively, dangerously dependent on proxies and indicators.
Which makes them the absolute prime targets for value inversion.
Exactly. The Fishery Management Board optimizes relentlessly for the proxy indicator. Tons of fish harvested per quarter. As long as that number goes up, the dashboard is green.
But the real fish are dying.
But the underlying reality is down the spawning rates, the genetic diversity of the fish, the health of the coral reefs is degrading. The fragmentation here is institutional. You have one agency managing water quality, another managing fishing permits, and a third managing coastal real estate.
And they aren't talking.
And none of them are integrating their signals. By the time the proxy dashboard finally shows a problem, when the fishing boats come back empty, the ecological threshold has already been crossed.
Wow.
The ecosystem has collapsed, and the options for restoration are incredibly compressed, requiring decades of total moratoriums.
And finally, let's apply this to the highest level of human coordination, governance, and political systems. And to be clear for our listeners, we are strictly looking at the structural theory here, impartially, as laid out in Dr. Sankely's text. We aren't commenting on any specific political party.
Purely structural.
How does this failure cascade apply to the governance of a nation?
At the level of national or global governance, the ruling group mind operates at a massive scale. The asymmetries of influence are immense. Certain concentrated actors, massive corporate lobbies, deeply entrenched bureaucracies, media conglomerates have overwhelming power to shape the prevailing policy narratives.
They control the story.
And to define the official indicators of societal success. They decide that the dashboard is defined by gross domestic product, or stock market indices, or specific employment metrics.
And if those official indicators are completely decoupled from the life ground, the actual lived reality of the citizens, the entire society experiences a devastating value inversion.
Yes.
The GDP can skyrocket while life expectancy drops, mental health plummets, and communities hollow out.
Yes. And as the government's epistemic closure deepens, as leaders surround themselves only with data that validates their policies, the societal system heavily fragments.
People drift apart.
Different groups of citizens begin to exist in entirely separate interpretive domains, consuming different media, experiencing different economic realities, and becoming structurally incapable of relating their perspectives to one another.
The relational field just breaks.
The shared relational field shatters. To counter this ultimate collapse, the text highlights the absolute vital importance of what it calls the civil commons.
The civil commons. We're talking about the physical and institutional structures of shared life. Public health systems, universal public education, shared infrastructure like parks and libraries, and environmental protections.
The civil commons acts as a systemic restorative structure. It is a societal anchor. It exists outside the profit proxy, functioning specifically to anchor the system back to the life ground, ensuring universal access to life-sustaining conditions.
So it's a structural safety net.
Furthermore, a robust civil commons maintains a shared, stable relational space where reliable signals can circulate across different classes and perspectives. If a society allows its civil commons to degrade or be privatized for proxy gains, the system loses its anchor to reality and catastrophic fragmentation becomes inevitable.
If we step back and connect all of this to the bigger picture, it is genuinely awe-inspiring.
It's a huge shift in thinking.
Whether you are looking at a critically ill patient in an ICU bed, an overextracted coastal ecosystem, or a fracturing national government, the invisible architecture of the failure cascade is structurally, mechanically the same.
It is a universal pattern. System awareness is not, and never can be, about finding one genius leader who knows everything. Awareness is a property of the relational field itself.
It's about the connections.
It is entirely about how well the system structure allows vital signals to flow, how fiercely it protects the capacity for doubt, and how closely its values are anchored to the sustaining of life.
Wow. We have covered an immense, challenging amount of ground today. Let's synthesize this journey so we can carry it forward.
Sounds good.
We started by dismantling the myth of the perfect view. Through the biology of cognition, we realized that our perception is structurally limited. We literally cannot see the whole picture. Because of that biological reality, divergent seeing things differently than our coworkers or neighbors is totally natural and inevitable.
But those divergent partial views have to coordinate, and they do so by communicating through signals.
Right.
We saw how those signals are aggressively filtered by the gravitational pull of incentives, rewarding data that maintains the status quo and punishing data that challenges it.
The filters turn into stories.
These filtered signals harden into rigid narratives. Once a narrative locks in, it actively rejects disconfirming reality, plunging the system into epistemic closure. The dashboard glows green, but it is entirely decoupled from the mountain we were flying toward.
And because the system is blind, it suffers from value inversion. It optimizes for artificial proxies, profit, throughput, GDP, instead of the life ground. It literally consumes its own capacity for life while looking perfectly, coherently successful on paper.
The ultimate lesson of the text is that coherence is not a static destination. It is not a state you achieve, build a dashboard for, and then forget about. True, life-sustaining coherence is an ongoing, relentless, active practice of relational alignment.
And that brings us directly to you, the listener. How does this massive framework apply to your world right now? Look at the systems you operate in daily. Are you trying to rigidly control an unpredictable, complex environment based on a flawed, highly curated dashboard?
Are you just staring at the metrics?
Or are you actively navigating it, keeping your eyes on the road, maintaining your margins, keeping your options open, and staying deeply sensitive to messy feedback? Are you paying attention to the weak signals, the quiet whispers of underlying reality? Or are you just comforting yourself with the loud, dominant narrative that everyone else in your echo chamber is repeating?
It requires a profound, often uncomfortable shift in mindset. It asks us to value the messy, ambiguous relational reality over the clean, comforting, but ultimately fatal illusion of the dashboard.
I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over today as you go back to your life. Take everything we've talked about, the corporations, the hospitals, the ecosystems, and point it inward.
Make it personal.
Think about the dashboard of your own life or your own career. Look at the metrics you are optimizing for every single day. Your daily output, your networking contacts, your bank account balance, your status on social media.
The personal proxies.
Are those proxies actually aligned with your personal life ground? Are they actively sustaining your physical health, your unstructured time, your social cohesion with the people you love, your baseline joy? Or have you achieved a state of perfect, plausworthy coherence around a proxy that is slowly, invisibly depleting your actual capacity for life?
That is the most vital question any of us can ask.
Keep your eyes off the dashboard for a moment and look out the window at the road. Look into the muddy waters because that's where reality actually lives. We don't need a cleaner, higher resolution X-ray machine. We need a fundamentally better way to navigate the mud. Thank you to our expert for this brilliant, illuminating guidance through a truly challenging and transformative text.
It has been an absolute privilege to unpack this framework with you.
And thank you, the listener, for taking this deep dive with us. Keep questioning the dashboard. Until next time.